We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is Bob Moriarty, founder of 321 Gold and 321 Energy. He was also a Marine Corps fighter pilot in Vietnam and a well-known author. How are you today, Bob?
I'm doing very well, Tom. I wish there was something that we could talk about that your viewers would find interesting, but I've been looking around. I don't see anything interesting going on.
Well, you know, it's been a real dry news couple of months here, so hopefully we can, you know, dig something out of the bottom of the barrel here.
No. Not a couple of months. It's been dry news for about 12 minutes.
Is that because your internet hasn't been working for 12 minutes?
No, I mean, strange stuff. I've got a friend coming in tonight, and you were getting some water, so I thought I'd make a quick look. I get dinner, okay, fixed in an hour and a half, 2 hours, and next door neighbor's coming over. So I checked my email to see how he was doing, because he was due here 30 minutes ago. It's no gas in France. There are two refineries that people are on strike, and they're demanding 15% increase. And aren't they going to be surprised when they find out 15% isn't going to cut it?
Absolutely. It seems like 15% is a small ask, really.
I've seen some very scary numbers. In Germany, year over year, PPI, not CPI, PPI was up 45.3%. Monthly CPI in Spain last month was up 186%. We are seeing incipient hyperinflation. And due to the stupidity of the Biden administration, I'm absolutely convinced it's coming to the U.S. Mm-hmm.
Well, Bob, let's say in that vein of thinking about, you know, asking for a small raise, and yet that has resulted in a strike that has, you know, shut basically gasoline off to all of France, as you're saying. You know, going through some material for today, it seems like a theme that you have been speaking about quite a bit lately is that much of the West's policies and reactions to crises are very self-destructive. So do you think that we can chalk this up to the idea that politicians typically do the wrong thing first before coming to the correct answer of what should be done?
Well, no, okay. They don't do the wrong thing first. They do the wrong thing, and then 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 do the wrong thing. I mean, look at the Fed. The Fed has painted themselves into a corner, and it doesn't make any difference which direction they go. If they keep quantitative tightening going, they blow up the economy, okay, and destroy the stock market. And if they do a pivot and go to quantitative easing, they go into hyperinflation. So discussing what the choices are for the Fed are really simple. Would you like to die of a heart attack, or would you like to die of lung cancer? And the fact of the matter is, if you're going to die, it doesn't make any difference whatsoever. One of the things I would be very interested in your take, you have some great guests. You have some really interesting people. When I look around the world and look at the leadership, I am totally dismayed, because I think the entire world is run by metal midgets, and they're doing some of the stupidest things possible. And I wrote a piece as soon as the Ukraine war started, saying that NATO and the EU and the US were going to commit suicide because of the sanctions. And everybody's using that term now. I think national governments are near terminal because they're being so bloody stupid.
So are you asking if I would agree with that idea that national government?
Tell me what do you see in leadership in the world?
I personally find it impossible to disagree with you in any way, shape, or form at this point. Oh.
That's nice. Okay. Maybe we should stop the interview right there. I mean, I'm willing to discuss just about every point, and I'm always hoping that somebody disagrees with me, because the only way you can figure out if you're right or not is to actually have to defend your point of view. But I was going to say,
Bob, it's no good if we agree that we're just in an echo chamber then.
Exactly right. It's like listening to a conch shell. Let's think you're hearing the ocean.
Well, I think what's interesting, or a good point to let's say analyze that idea, is to think about the incentives. You know, why do you think governments are instituting these policies that are very seemingly self-destructive? Let's take the sanctions, for example, right? We're going to sequester Russia and basically drive up the cost of every product that they're producing for the rest of the world. And if we look at the actual outcome of what the sanctions have been, and, you know, while on top of the inflation that we've already seen in a bunch of those commodities and energy, those problems existed before the war in Ukraine. Now we're going to add on sanctions and really exacerbate that problem. Like, it just doesn't make any sense. But if we step back, and I always try to look at the incentives of, let's say, what these governments are trying to do, that seems to be more telling to me for the outcome of some of these issues.
I think it's a lot simpler than that. First of all, governments attract sociopaths. These are people who want power. I am astounded at the stupidity of their actions, and I don't think there's any particular incentive. I think these are like organ grinder monkeys. They have no idea of what they're doing whatsoever. Governments are attracted to short-term solutions, and they ignore long-term problems. You and I were talking about the EU's policy of, we don't want the consumers hurt, so we're going to spend $1.6 trillion to make sure the consumers don't pay the market price for fuel. Now, mm-hmm. the crazy thing, and my degree was in economics. Economics works, okay? And the last thing that you want to do is mess with the signals from supply and demand. Now, mm-hmm. if the price of electricity goes up 1,000%, why would it be a good idea for the government to pay the 1,000% rather than the consumer? Because if you're the consumer and the price of fuel goes up 1,000%, you use less. And that's a good signal, because that's how economics is supposed to work. Governments, on the other hand, we don't give a damn. We just go spend $1.6 trillion. And the fatal flaw to that, of course, is, well, that $1.6 trillion has to come from the consumers. And if it comes from the consumer, who gives a rat's ass whether they pay it today or whether they pay it next week? Same thing.
Mm-hmm. It's very reminiscent of the quote unquote Inflation Reduction Act that is going to pour, you know, trillions more dollars of printed or borrowed currency into that system, right? It's a problem of, as you said, supply and demand, and those signals are really important. It's never a magic fix. It's always trade-offs.
Well, not necessarily trade-offs. Okay. Name one good thing for the Europeans in the sanctions.
Virtue signaling?
Do not even go there. You know, get me started on virtue signaling. There is nothing. There is no benefit whatsoever. You know, I'm going to suck Uncle Sam's weenie, okay, because he said we got to put sanctions on Russia because it's going to hurt Russia. Well, if it doesn't hurt Russia, why do it? It's so insane that the Germans had 8 months that they could turn Nord Stream 2 on, and they waited until the United States blew it up. When the United States blew it up, okay, they screwed it up. They only hit 3 out of the 4 pipelines. So Germany's in the same position now, where if they want to end the fuel crisis, all they have to do is go to Russia and say, you know, we hate you. We hate Putin. We're going to send all our tanks to Ukraine. But on the other hand, we like your natural gas. We're going
to not freezing to death, maybe.
Yeah, but here's what's crazy. It's very important to understand. Europe needs Russia, period. They're their next-door neighbor. They're loaded with natural resources, but Russia does not need Europe. So the United States got their little buddies in Europe to get together and put sanctions on Russia. I saw it absolutely clearly, suicide. And one of the things that I went over this with you a little while ago, somebody in Europe, in the EU Parliament, was talking to the United States and said, well, look, you guys are paying $7 per British thermal unit for natural gas. And when you ship LNG to us, you're charging $60, and that doesn't seem fair. And of course, Blinken, and this is a perfect example of short-term stupidity, Blinken comes out and says, well, we see the destruction of the Nord Stream pipelines as having a tremendous advantage to the United States. But the Europeans can look at it and say, why are we paying $60 to the Americans and they're only paying $7? This can only have very negative reactions. And the relationship between the United States and the rest of the world is going to change more in the next year than it's changed in the last 200 years, when the Europeans realized how thoroughly they have been screwed and literally put out of business. They're going to be pretty angry.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting that you bring up that point, Bob. I've heard you speak a lot about the law of unintended consequences. So is this, you know, the pipeline attacks a great example of that?
Would you like one better?
Sure.
Okay. Up until about 1955 in the United States, we had milkmen. And they would drive around in vans, and they would bring in milk and butter and eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere 10 or 15 years ago, they came out with these home DNA tests. And a woman living in California sent in the home DNA test and came back. She was shocked to find that her father wasn't really her father. But on the other hand, she had dozens of siblings about the same age. And she kept getting reports every month, and every month there were more people who signed up for the DNA service. And she ended up with 600 brothers and sisters. And the DNA company looked into it and said, this is really weird. I mean, what happened? And it turns out that the common denominator was a guy who had been a milkman in Southern California during the late 40s and 50s, and he would be, you know, delivering milk and cheese and butter and things, and Mrs. Smith would answer the phone, say, is there anything else you need, Mrs. Smith? And she'd smile and say, well, yeah, why don't you come in and have a cup of coffee? And 600 visits later, he was a very happy, proud father. So unintended consequences, some are predictable and some are unpredictable. And that the comment from Blinken that it was a tremendous opportunity for the United States, they're going to bury him and put those words on his tombstone, because he's going to regret ever having said that. The Europeans are going to realize, you know, the United States doesn't care about us. And if it destroys our economy, which it's going to, they're going to be pretty angry.
Well, and I mean, we can look at a couple different examples of how it already is starting. Like, let's look at the Bank of England having to come back in and really sacrifice the pound in order to prop up their bond market and their pension funds.
They didn't sacrifice the pound.
Why is that?
They didn't know it was going to happen. Okay, remember? Okay. Right. They decreased taxes, they increased subsidies, the pound collapses, okay? The bond market is about to collapse. It was all unintended consequences. It never occurred to them. I mean, the Truss, okay, the prime minister, excuse me, the shortest-lived prime minister in British history. It never occurred to them that the things that they were going to do were going to destroy the pound. I hate to say it, but governments are stupid. And I'm an equal opportunity anarchist. I despise all governments equally, but they're all stupid. And they do these incredibly short-sighted things. And unfortunately, what happened to the British bond market is going to happen in the EU. It's going to be worse in the EU than it is in Britain, but it's going to happen in the United States. I gave you a number. If you go back to December of 2021, the highest rated bonds in the UK are down 52.3%. That's catastrophic. Every pension fund in the world is bankrupt. And when people wake up to that fact, they're just going to shut the banks down. I mean, we're going to see things very soon that people just can't imagine. I'm surprised. I'm one of the most negative guys around.
Well, Bob, you know, if that same situation happens in more countries, or let's say in the US, what happens to the currency at that point? Are the pension funds a really good example of a market that is too big to fail?
Nothing is too big to fail. Okay. It's only the impact that is too big to ponder. Some things are so predictable. Okay, here's how currency markets work. All money is loaned into existence. When you loan money into existence in a debt-based system, there is interest charged. Mm-hmm. So from a mathematical point of view, there is always more debt than there is money. Now, this has been true for thousands of years. Got any idea what the Babylonians did?
Nope. Enlighten me.
They would have a debt jubilee, okay? Because the Babylonian kings realized we don't want to put the farmers out of business. In the Western debt-based system that comes from both Greece and Rome, the theory was the debt always has to be paid, or the debtor literally would be sold into slavery and its family, you know. I don't know what they'd do with family. I guess it put them in slavery too. But the debtor would lose everything. But in Babylon and in Palestine, they realized, hey, wait a minute. We can't afford to shut our economy down. Therefore, we'll have a jubilee. I believe there will be some kind of jubilee, because I don't think there's any other possible alternative. There's $300 trillion debt in the world, and there isn't $300 trillion worth of money to pay it. It can't be paid. Nobody I know thinks it can be paid.
So, Bob, how do you think that actually works? Does it just, let's say, net out what one country owes the other? Or, like, what are the mechanics of what a debt jubilee actually looks like?
Well, the real beautiful thing is we have no idea We have no clue as to what's going to happen. But when every pension fund blows up, when inflation is 80 or 100 or 150%, what do you do then? Now then, there was a revolution in France, started in 1789. It started because the people in Paris couldn't afford wheat. And that was because the French king bankrupted the country by supporting the American colonists in the American Revolutionary War. So they came up with a currency, a paper currency, and printed it like crazy, like they always do, and it failed. And then they had that was called, let me think of what the name is. I'll think of it in a minute. That was followed with another currency in 1795 called the mandat, and that failed. And then a French colonel started a revolution, and he took control of France. Got any idea who that was?
He
was a little short guy.
Napoleon?
Yeah, exactly right. Okay. Napoleon said, "This bullshit. Okay, we need to go back to real money." So he went back to gold and silver, and the economy recovered. Governments always do the right thing, and they always do the wrong thing, and they only get around to doing the right thing when all of the solutions they've come up with before fail. Which currency is going to collapse fast? It's really hard to tell. In February, the Russian ruble got up to, I think, 155 or 165 to the dollar. And the United States was thrilled because they knew they were going to destroy Putin and they could take over Russia. So they came out with sanctions. Putin increased interest rates. The sanctions hit, and the price of oil and natural gas and all the commodities that Russia had lots of went through the roof. So he was smiling, and everybody in Europe saying, "Hey, you know, how'd that happen? Okay, that wasn't supposed to happen." The Russian ruble is now something like 53 or 55 to the dollar. It has been the strongest currency in the world since February this year because of the actions of the United States. And the really funny thing is that there is no fuel crisis in the world. There is no food crisis in the world. This is something entirely voluntary. And it's like being stupid in a day of the internet. If you're stupid and uneducated today, it's entirely voluntary. Okay, nobody made you stupid. There's tons of information available if you will seek it out, find it. And quite bluntly, I feel sorry for the Europeans. I'm really disappointed. The quality of the leadership is so poor across the board in Europe, and they're going to pay for it in a big way. We're just talking about the price of fuel in France. I've got a little tiny place here, and I get heat from firewood, which I cut myself, and I've got kerosene heaters, and I've got a pellet stove and a small farm that I've got here. Pellets have gone from 3.5 euros to the bag to 8. Kerosene that I use for the little stoves has increased 150%. Gasoline, it's up 50%. So we're edging on hyperinflation right now, and everything they're doing is making it worse. And the fact of the matter is France is going to shut down 3 nuclear power stations by the end of the year. So we've got an energy crisis in Europe, but it's being made far worse by the quality of the leadership.
And like you say, it's in some ways it's been absolutely voluntary.
100%. Okay. Nobody forced them into doing this. And some of the things like Germany gets 60% of its natural gas from Russia. It is as simple as they either get the natural gas from Russia or they shut the country down. There's two different ways that you can destroy someone with a commodity like natural gas. Now, the one thing that occurs to everybody is, well, you know, if we want them to suffer, all we have to do is stop using natural gas. But there's another way, and that is to increase the price so much that people can't afford to pay it. I feel very sorry for people in Europe, in the UK, in the United States. The price increases that are already built into the system are going to be catastrophic for literally billions of people.
Yeah, like you say, it's adding so much cost to people's everyday lives that it's going to make energy basically inaccessible to them.
Hang on, not just energy, because food is an analog of energy. Okay. Yep,
great point.
Food and fuel. So people are going to starve and they're going to freeze or they're going to go bankrupt.
I wanted to go back to, let's say, the strength of the dollar for a little bit, Bob. You know, I've seen some predictions of the DXY going to 140 or 160, but what would the rest of the world look like at those levels?
The best guy that I know is Bob Hoy. And he was predicting 120 a year ago, but the answer is quite simple. That we're already seeing it. It's catastrophic at 114. Now, the reason the dollar is so high, it is very confusing to most people. When you borrow money in dollars, that is a synthetic short against the dollar. Because when you pay it back, you got to pay it back in dollars. So when you've got a currency like the British pound that's gone from 140 to 103, you not only have the increase in inflation, you've got the decrease in the value of the pound, which forces the value of the dollar to go up. There is no dollar, okay, that actually exists. The dollar index is a pseudo index. There's no dollars behind it. People don't understand that. The dollar index is a combination of the British pound, the Japanese yen, the euro, and other smaller currencies. So when the dollar index goes up, it's not because the dollar is getting more valuable, it's the other currencies are going down. And some of the things like the British pension bond crisis, There's no fixing that, okay? There's no solution other than write off all that debt. So going back to your question about how do we initiate, what are we doing at Jubilee? The answer is nobody in the entire world knows. My particular opinion is the solution is to go back to gold because that's worked for 5,000 years and that's what they'll end up doing. Nobody will want to do it, but they're going to do it because they have to. Mm-hmm.
So again, what does that look like? You know, if there was a recent U.S. senator or congressman or whatever he was that introduced a bill to go back to the gold standard, but considering the constraints that a gold standard places on a government and considering the amount of debt in the world right now, do we not have to, let's say, restart with a new currency and then constrain it to gold?
The answer is yes and no. Mm-hmm. One of the things I'm convinced Putin is 100 times smarter than most people give him credit for. And I'm convinced that he understands the debt-based system is dysfunctional and needs replacing. And I'm convinced that the BRICS will go to a gold standard because it's the easy, quick solution to a new financial system. So what's going to happen is the debt-based system that goes back to Greece and Roman times is going to literally evaporate. The United States and Europe are going to be turned into third world shitholes.
Is that a technical term, Bob?
Yeah. Economics 101.
You know, one thing that I don't think I've gotten your take on before, Bob, is your take on gold and silver manipulation. So what camp do you belong to there? You know, we have people that say it's overt, and the governments, let's say around the world, or let's say the US government, has a particular interest in keeping the value of gold down because it doesn't highlight the decrease in confidence in the US dollar. So what side of the aisle do you fall on there?
There are two guys who started that whole manipulation conspiracy thing. One of them had been tossed out of the commodities market. He was a silver expert for trying to corner orange juice, and he was thrown out on a permanent base by the CFTC. Mm-hmm. The other one had stolen from 200 of his own clients, and he had been tossed out of commodities on a permanent basis by the CFTC. Now, the difference between the American education system and the British education system is, in the American education system, you're taught the answers are important. In the British education system, you're taught the questions are important. If you ask the wrong question, what do you get?
The wrong answer.
Thank you. It is that simple. The question is far more important than the answer. So then, there are 100 different financial commodities, markets, etc. Will you name one that's not manipulated?
Can't come up with one off the top of my head that
Tom, that, you mean you're telling me everything's manipulated? Of course you are. And the reason for it is that every financial market has always been manipulated, mm-hmm. always will be manipulated. And what possible difference does it make? And the answer is none. Mm-hmm. Now then, the guy who is an expert on silver said that silver at $4 an ounce is going to be the most valuable commodity. We ever get into a war, it's going to go to $50 to $100 an ounce just because of that. And he said silver, the price of silver is suppressed. And silver went from $4.03 to just short of $50. So the trick question of the day is, was silver suppressed? If that was suppressed, that was the least effective suppression in world history. Mm-hmm. Gold got down $252, and I think it's 1960 or something like that today. So gold going from 252 to 1760, was that suppressed? People love the idea of manipulation. They love the idea of conspiracy because it's a great reason when your wife says, honey, you know, we had 50,000 in our account a year ago, we got 3,000 now. What happened? You say, well, manipulation, dear.
Yeah, it's always interesting to see manipulation when, let's say, the price goes down, the explanation of manipulation when the price goes down, but not when it goes up, right?
Well, I have predicted both tops and bottoms with a fairly regular and fairly accurate way. I don't think anybody can pinpoint these things, but I made a lot of predictions that were really close. I did an interview on September 1st, and silver was down big, like a buck or so an ounce. And I said that I think that, you know, we're days or minutes away from a bottom. If you go back and look at the price of silver, it bottomed on September 1st. Now, it took 3 weeks for gold to make the bottom, but there were other things going on to cause that. But if someone accurately predicted either top or bottom, and manipulation was important, it would mean that person would have to be part of the manipulation. And I've written books about it, and I honestly believe anybody can predict tops and bottoms. I've given some really handy tools that people can use. And if they use those tools, they can figure out whether a bear market or a bull market. In my articles, and I wrote a piece, I think on September 26th, saying gold stocks capitulating. And mm-hmm. I think gold stocks did capitulate that period. And quite bluntly, anybody can figure that out. It's not rocket science.
So, Bob, as you're mentioning gold stocks, does the fact that we've seen junior miner share prices get crushed lately have anything to do with the price of gold and silver themselves?
Zero. If you go back to 2008 and you go back to 2015, we had a bottom in 2001, we had a bottom in 2008, we had a bottom in 2015, and both 2001 and 8 and 15, you had dozens of stocks selling for less than the cash they had on hand. But what actually happened in both 2008 and 2015, there were half a dozen gold funds, and they were getting redemptions, and they were being forced to sell. And that drove the price far below what it would have been supported. There were some extraordinary opportunities. There are some extraordinary opportunities right now. Relative to the stock market, relative to the commodities index, relative to the price of gold and silver, the price of resource stocks now are cheaper than they have ever been. You want to make money in anything, you want to buy it when it's at its cheapest. And if you want to make money in anything, you want to sell it when it's at its most expensive. Everybody wants to make this shit complicated. It's not complicated. You buy cheap and sell dear, you make money. Mm-hmm.
You know, you had mentioned to me earlier, I think before we hit record here, is that you're a major contrarian. So is this negative sentiment and the fact that most investors have written the sector off a great indicator for you of when to buy?
100%. Absolutely. In April of 2011, when silver topped at 49.86 or something like that, Eric Sprott was out touting his silver ETF, SLV. And investors were paying a 26% premium for his silver ETF over the price of silver. If you went into a coin store and wanted to buy silver or gold, and they were charging 26% premium, they're gouging you. But he was getting it for his ETF because he had done such a great job of marketing. The only reason people buy or sell anything is because of sentiment. And if you can measure that sentiment accurately, I predicted the top of silver to the day in 2011. And I was doing it based on the action of Eric Sprott and the SLV. Anybody could do the same thing. At every top, there's 50 reasons to buy. And at every bottom, there's 50 reasons to sell. So all you have to do is look around, see what else is everybody else is doing, and do the opposite. Mm-hmm.
Was that SLV or PSLV?
I'm sorry, you're right. Absolutely, it's PSLV. Okay. Yeah, physical, Sprott Silver Physical Asset. Yeah, mm-hmm. PSLV. Thank you.
So, Bob, you recently wrote an article about a story involving learning how to shoot craps and how to actually make money at it. So how does that compare to the junior resource market?
Exactly the same.
So how do you actually make money, and how does the junior market compare to shooting craps?
It's easier. Okay. If you go to Vegas, and you have studied probability and permutations, which I have, there's odds on every roll of the dice. And if you take the correct odds in Las Vegas, you can get the odds against you down to about 0.75%. And what that means is that for you to lose $741, $100,000 has to cross the table back and forth. At some point in time in the evening, you will have more money on your side of the table than you started with. If you will get up and leave the table, you'll make money. Now, if you sit at the table and keep rolling the dice, the odds don't change. But what happens sooner or later is your $741 gets whittled away to nothing. And by the end of the evening, $100,000 is crossed the table. And you lost $741 because you kept rolling the dice. The amazing thing about the junior resource market is that stocks can go up 10, 15, 20% a day sometimes, and they do all the time. If you buy stocks when they're at a yearly low and you sell them when they're at a yearly high, you can make money. The range, the yearly range, and I studied this in a bunch of stocks that I owned once, I think the average yearly range was 186% between the low and the high. So if you buy near the bottom, hold it for a 25 or 50% gain, which would be a home run according to anybody, you can make money every year. And believe it or not, you can make money on the biggest piece of crap stocks out there. But the key is you have to buy when things are cheap. And you have to be willing to take a profit. If you're not willing to take a profit, the only other alternative is you take a loss. And people pretend that really good stocks, some guru has recommended to them, is more beautiful than my wife, and I'm going to marry it. Well, doesn't might work with beautiful women, but it doesn't work with stocks. Don't marry the damn things. They're trading cards, okay? Take a profit while you can. If you do that, you'll make money every time.
Mm-hmm. So, Bob, when we think about what's going on in the world today with the possibility for some type of economic collapse or reset in the markets, how do you look at investing in juniors versus investing in physical metals or you know, tangible assets?
Okay, that's a really good question. You own a car.
Yep.
You own a house.
Nope.
Well, okay, let me ask a question.
Let's just say yes then.
Okay. You have insurance on them.
Unfortunately.
Why?
For the just-in-case scenario and because it's required of me.
That's a good answer because it's required, so it doesn't make any difference whether you want to or not. The government says you got to have insurance. But the fact of the matter is we insure things because we value them and we recognize that there's a certain risk. Mm-hmm. Do you want to collect on the insurance?
You should, yeah.
No. Okay, you got an insured car. You're saying week from now you want to collect on it? Really? Did you just tell me you want your car wrecked?
I would like to have some way of collecting on the amount of insurance that I've paid without having any type of incident.
That's not going to happen. Okay, you pay a price for insurance. Mm-hmm. But you hope you don't have to collect, okay? That's part of the cost of living. I mean, you don't care about that. You have insurance on a car, and you hope you don't collect. I don't think I've collected a penny in insurance, and this is really funny, in probably 20 or 25 years. I had a BMW convertible, a 320, BMW, a beautiful car, white car, blue top. And the dumbest car thief in Miami broke into the car and stole a radio. Now, the car was 10 years old when I bought the car, okay? I'm not sure what the value of a 10-year-old BMW radio is, but he cut the top to get into the vehicle, and then he stole the radio out. And I got insurance, and I don't particularly care whether I collect or not. Okay, I leave my cards open. That's what insurance is for. I got paid for the radio, for a brand new radio, and for a brand new top. That was the last time I collected. We own gold and silver not because we want to profit. We own gold and silver because we want an insurance policy against financial chaos. I can't tell you the last time. Well, actually, I can tell you, in 2011, Barbara and I had a 1,024-ounce Atosha silver bar that we had paid $5.35 an ounce for, and I sold it for $45 an ounce, and it was a beautiful silver bar. We used to use it as a doorstop. But I thought, you know, this thing's gone from $5 to $45, and, you know, I could probably use the money and do something else with it. We buy physical gold and silver to have an insurance policy. We buy junior resource stocks to speculate.
Great answer. And I like the way that you, let's say, define each one and what their actual role is in your portfolio and in your head, let's say.
Yeah, it's very important to do that because you actually need both of them, okay? Hopefully, people have some resources to speculate, but absolutely catastrophically, people absolutely need insurance policy, and that's what gold and silver is. I mean, I showed it to you. I've got some silver like 10 feet away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So Bob, you're a pretty well-known author. What have you been up to lately? What has caught your attention?
Oh, Tom, I hate it when you ask those questions. Bob, you are so incompetent. You wrote a book 30 years ago and you finally got around to publishing it. What's wrong with you?
Oh, I think I asked the question a little bit nicer than that.
Yeah, but the fact
that may have been the implication, but that was that I asked it nicer than that.
I can't spell. I've got an identical twin brother. He has the exact same problem. If I took a typewriter and wrote a page and you read it, you'd think, God, this guy is illiterate. He's misspelling some of the simplest words in the universe. Given all the time I had in combat, okay, it would have been very easy for me in the 70s or 80s to have written the definitive book about marine aviation as both fighter pilot and observation pilot, but I can't spell. So I would type up pages and pages and pages, and I would send it off to publishing companies, and they would come back and say, you know, resubmit this to us when you learn to spell. I don't think I'm going to last that long. And of course, my excuse was, wait a minute, I'm a writer. Nobody pays you to be a speller. But between 1974 and 1985, I delivered small airplanes all over the world. I did 243 trips, single-engine Cessnas, Pipers, Beech. And I actually wrote a book over 30 years ago, as soon as they came out with computers that had spell checkers, which I thought was like heaven. I wrote the book 30 years ago, but I never got around to publishing. It's very easy to publish books now. So I dusted off the copy that I had, and I literally finished it. That's the book right there, No Guts, No Glory. And I wrote about 240 trips and a dozen air records and flying the Eiffel Tower and I think four air races. Kind of an interesting book. But people who know me, I happen to be a very funny writer. They're going to see a side to me that's going to be a surprise to them. Very few people know that I delivered small planes.
Yeah, of course, you and I talked about, I think the very first time I spoke with you, talked about you flying under the Eiffel Tower. That's, I think, a feat that nobody else can claim, right?
I think it's been done. Somebody tried it in 1926, but he came from the wrong direction. He hit the side. I have seen a picture that I believe to be accurate of a small British twin-engine airplane, I think did it during World War II. And there was an American who claimed to be a fighter pilot and had flown through in air-to-air combat. And I actually talked to him. I said, look, I was a fighter pilot. I'm going to tell you, that story's bullshit. You simply would not do that with your life on the line. So and actually, in 1989, the French ambassador to the United States called me up, said, are you Bob Moriarty? And I said, yeah. And he said, you flew under the Eiffel Tower? And I said, yes. And he said, did you do it again recently? And I said, no. And he said, well, somebody did. We were wondering if it was you. I said, why would I do it? I've already done it. So I think there are three, what I would believe, verifiable examples. And you can never do it today. I mean, I did it in 1984, and that was in a totally different world. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Well, Bob, I think that's a reasonable place to wrap up today's conversation. Is there anything else on your mind that you want to leave our listeners with?
This is an extraordinarily dangerous period in world history. There are currents going on. I can't predict what's going to happen tomorrow, but there's some very bad things. And I would highly encourage everyone to do as much research into things as you could. We know now that 100% of what we were told about COVID was a lie. Okay, they're still discovering lies. The government's lying about everything in Ukraine. The government's lying about everything in finance. And you have to take responsibility for yourself. There are no gurus. Okay, I'm not a guru or an expert any more than anybody else is. But it's a very important time to take control of your life, your family, your finances, and do what makes sense for you. And the only way you can do that is to educate yourself. And just because it's on the web, you don't have to believe it. Doesn't make sense, don't believe it. Doesn't make sense, do believe it.
Some sound advice there, Bob. I appreciate that. And of course, a lot of the articles that you write, your opinion and all kinds of different articles are available at 321gold and 321energy.com, right?
Yes.
Perfect. Bob, thanks so much for your time today.
Tom, it's always a pleasure talking to you. We can go out for hours and hours and hours, but thank you very much. Great question. It's always fun.
Thank you, Bob.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.